This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
And welcome to Natural Life. I'm Kim McCurdy. In this half hour, I'll be reading articles of interest from magazines like Hobby Farms and Mother Earth News that may help us to live a little more naturally. We'll get started today with the Hobby Farms magazine, January-February 2024. This first article is called A New Harvest. Agrivoltaics is sparking interest on farms of all sizes across the country. By Nikki Work-Wellander. Gina Thurn describes farming in New England as idyllic. Rolling hills, scenic vistas, and picturesque farmhouses. Solar panels aren't typically a part of that mental image, but the Rhode Island farmer who runs Our Kids Farm with her husband Lauren thinks they should be. When the Thurns added a small solar array to their modest farm, less than 5 acres, with a half acre in agricultural production, their goal was like the goals of most farmers across America. They wanted to get creative with their resources to benefit production, profit, and the land itself. Our Kids Farm is far from the only farm dipping its toe into renewable energy. An emerging trend called agrivoltaics, a combination of the words agriculture and photovoltaics, is popping up at more research facilities, pastures, and farms nationwide. Agrivoltaics is the practice of developing land for solar energy production while also keeping it in agricultural production. That can look a few different ways, such as growing crops, running livestock, cultivating pollinator habitats, and more. But no matter what method you choose, and for farms of all sizes, agrivoltaics can be innovative ways to introduce new revenue, new opportunities, and new ways of thinking. Benefits of agrivoltaics. For Our Kids Farm, venturing into agrivoltaics allowed for double the benefits from just one plot of land. It's about making the maximum use of your space possible, Gina Thurn says. We asked ourselves, what can we do with the resources and the space that we have to expand our growing season from a 6 or 8 month growing season to a year-round growing season? The fence surrounding the panels provide built-in trellising space for climbing plants. The shade offered by the panels extends the growing season for shade-loving and cool-weather crops. That shade is one of the huge benefits of agrivoltaics, according to Byron Komenek, owner and manager of Jack's Solar Garden in Longmont, Colorado. Relief from the blistering dry heat of Colorado summers can keep livestock cooler, crops healthier, and importantly, farm workers safer. Having a little bit of shade on the ground helps not just the crops and the soils, but also the people that are there, Komenek says. They can plan their days around where the shade is going to move because we know how the sun is going to move throughout the day. They can always just be a few steps away from the shade, and they can leave their water bottles in the shade to keep those cool. Jack's Solar Garden, which is also home to the Colorado Agrivoltaic Learning Center, is the largest commercially active agrivoltaics research facility in the U.S. and has panels that follow the sun throughout the day. Those panels offer revolving shade schedules, but even for fixed panels that don't move, the shady times of the day are easy to plan for. The panels at Jack's Solar Garden are tall, ranging from 6 to 8 feet, with enough room for people to work and run machinery underneath. The height of the panels determines how you can best utilize the land. That doesn't mean shorter panels can't be successful. The name of the game is matching the crop to the logistics of the array. If you're growing tomatoes, you'll need your panels to be taller. If you're focusing on pollinator habitats and know you won't need to get any machinery underneath the panels, shorter panels may be a good fit. I try to tell folks it's all about diversification, Komenek says. If you have shorter panels, you limit what you're able to do there. It kind of just depends on what your expertise is. He went on to say that diversification doesn't have to stop at crops. Komenek recommends future-proofing your operation by making sure you can grow different kinds of products in and around your solar array, as well as in thinking about how to right-size the investments in the array itself. Not every panel has to be 6 feet tall, but even if some of them are, you're setting yourself up for more success. The U's have it. The solar array Emily Montell ran her sheep under in 2022 in Fairfield, Iowa, had panels significantly shorter than those at Jack's Solar Garden. The panels were tall enough for her 29 ewes and a ram, and the resulting lambs, to peacefully graze under, but not tall enough for Montell herself to clear. While Montell's solar sheep was a brief project starting in May 2022 and wrapping up before the end of the year, it was a positive experiment to see how well sheep could thrive on solar array pasture land. Montell was able to run the sheep successfully for the full summer and fall without having to supplement their feed. This was in large part because the pasture had been planted as a pollinator garden, which thrived under the shade of the panels. Plus, the sheep and the bees loved the mix of chicory, clover, and plantain leaves. By the end of the summer, you couldn't tell that the small herd of fat, happy sheep was grass-fed rather than grain-fed. The sheep just do their own thing, Montell says. The solar panels are perfect because they always provide shade for them. They were really happy. While Montell ended up selling the herd and moving to Virginia, she has been brainstorming new ways to bring agrivoltaics to a pasture, or maybe even a vineyard near her. It's all gravy. Farming on a solar array can have big agricultural yields, and it can also yield big savings, and depending on the size of the operation, big earnings too. Our kids' farm is able to offset 100% of their annual energy costs from what their panels generate, which is a huge benefit as energy costs are the farm's single largest annual expense. For larger scale developments, paying your own electricity bills can turn into selling electricity to others. At Jack's Solar Garden, which used to be a hay farm from 1972 when Cominex's grandfather bought it, up until as recently as 2019, some 3,200 solar panels produce enough power to power more than 300 homes. Cominex has residential and commercial subscribers who benefit from the energy produced at Jack's Solar Garden, as well as larger municipal clients such as the City of Boulder and Boulder County. We make more money off of selling electricity than we ever did off of haying, Cominex says. So in terms of the stuff growing underneath the solar panels, basically that's all gravy. But even for the smaller operations, the return on investment is substantial. Thurn, who rents the solar equipment from a local company, estimates that between the revenue from the crops grown in the solar array and the savings on energy costs, her family would be able to afford to buy outright all the solar equipment within 5 to 7 years. While their rental agreement works well for them right now, knowing that they're generating that kind of revenue makes a big difference. The Thurns are also saving money on water for their array because due to the setup of the panels, they can capture rainwater that then goes back into the crops. Potential obstacles. The field of agrivoltaics may be newer in the U.S., but it's far from new internationally. Many other countries worldwide, including Japan, Germany, and France, have been incorporating agrivoltaic practices for years. As the U.S. continues to grow and expand in this field, however, there are challenges on the horizon. One of the largest of those is the obstacles farmers face in being able to install solar in the first place. That peaceful Rhode Island aesthetic mentioned before, Thurn has found that old habits die hard, and some local policies make solar development nearly impossible for smaller producers. In those instances, she says, it's all about advocacy. The challenge has been trying to get people to understand that we can change, we can still look good, and we can have rural character, she says. We can still produce fresh vegetables and raise livestock and do all of these things in the same space as solar. Adding a solar array doesn't have to take land out of production. In fact, you can maximize the production and keep your farm viable. That land doesn't have to stay empty. Use it. Use it twice, and it's double productive. For Cominex, the political challenges of agrivoltaics extend beyond the city, town, and county councils, and all the way up to the state and national policies that impact just how beneficial solar energy development can be for farmers. He shares that while many policymakers have an interest in renewable energy, it has to be about more than the money, and about the environmental factors and land stewardship. He sees the future success of the agrivoltaics industry hinging on more focus on land conservation, tying in easements, and truly valuing renewable energy and those who produce it. At the end of the day, the land and how to not only develop it for agrivoltaics, but also how to protect it for native species and for future use needs to be seen as just as valuable as the electricity it can produce. It's just what farmers do. When Thurn gets flack from others in her community about solar farming, she understands. People tell her a solar farm isn't really a farm, but she reminds them that she is far from the first farmer to do something crazy in the name of making things better for her land, her family, and her community. It's about thinking outside the box and being a little bit creative and doing what farmers have done for generations of trying to be entrepreneurs and be investors, inventors, and use the land in new ways, Thurn says. It keeps you viable. And part of that viability is keeping farming a tenable option in her community. Farmers in the New England area are often land rich but crop poor because the value and cost of their land far outweighs what they can produce on it. For farming and farm families such as hers to survive in that kind of economic situation, growing and strengthening local resilience is vital. Kominek feels that focusing on being more local is what agrivoltaics is all about, and that's one of the ways it aligns so well with the rest of the agricultural industry, especially small and hobby farmers. It's about having local power of production, he says. When you have your own on-site solar needs and you can have on-site food production, it's close for you and your neighbors, and it can create jobs in that local area. It really is all about being local versus trying to extract from somewhere else. Good for the next generation. When Thurn and her husband first bought their farm, she was pregnant with their first child. It was 2007, and 6 months later, the economy crashed. I had to figure out how to keep food on my kids' plate, and the ability to be innovative and do things differently and think outside the box is what kept us alive, she says. Now, almost 16 years later, as her oldest son has watched his parents innovate, risk, and tinker, he's following in their footsteps. After watching the agrivoltaics efforts on the farm, he's found a passion for renewable energy and is starting a program at school focusing on wind energy and turbines. Knowing that her child is pursuing an interest that might make the world a little better is gratifying. Knowing her efforts are making the world a little better for two sons is gratifying, too. It's about being able to pass on that knowledge, whether my kids farm or not, Thurn says. They are thinkers. They see that they can do something that's good and right and be different, and that's okay. It empowers them to be dreamers, to accomplish different goals, and to do something that's good for the environment. It's something I'm really proud of. Nikki Wellander is a journalist living in Colorado. She earned her bachelor's degree in journalism from Metropolitan State University in Denver and has worked in media and communications for more than 15 years. There are a couple of small inset articles to add to this. So here's the first one, 5 tips to get started. Check local ordinances. The first step is to find out what is possible in your area and within the confines of whatever space you have available. If local ordinances aren't clear, contact local policymakers for guidance. Gina Thurn of Our Kids Farm in Exeter, Rhode Island, encourages people to not give up at the first no, but rather to keep advocating for themselves and to find out what might be possible if they just ask. Secure the solar. Whether it's leasing panels from a local company, working with a research facility or university, or installing your own panels and selling the energy to a utility, make a plan for how you will get the panels in place. Look into what kind of panels you will use, and make sure to account for the height and distance between rows you will need. Make sure that the utility company is on board with agrivoltaics before you get too far into the process, especially if you're leasing equipment. Plan the production. If you're looking to grow crops, do your research into what will grow well in your area, as well as what grows as well on a solar array. If you want to run livestock, consider what type of livestock will work well. For example, goats are likely to destroy solar panels, whereas sheep are more prone to leave the equipment alone. Make sure you plan what you will grow and how you will grow it, as well as how you will preserve the solar array at the same time, i.e. protecting wires, navigating equipment, etc. Phone a friend. There are many agrivoltaic research projects across the country, from those funded by the National Renewable Energy Laboratory to those housed at or sponsored by major universities such as Colorado State University, the University of Arizona, University of Massachusetts, and many more. Plus, many private solar companies have their own research projects. Reach out to any of these in your area and see if there are lessons learned they can share. You can also reach out to farmers in your area who have implemented agrivoltaics. Use the Inspire Agrivoltaics map online to find resources and information near you. Trial and error. Just like any other venture into hobby farming, it takes time to get it right. Take risks, ask questions, and keep trying. Here's one other little inset article, Undercover. Plenty of crops can thrive under solar panels. Here are 15 such crops that have worked well for the sources of this story. But you should defer to your local climate needs. Arugula, berries, bok choy, celery, collard greens, herbs, kale, lettuce, radishes, rhubarb, spinach, squash, Swiss chard, and tomatoes. Moving on to the next article, we'll stick with the same Hobby Farms magazine. This is a column called Unconventional Gardening by Susan M. Brackney. Bulbs attract bees and beneficials. Beyond providing an extra splash of color for our own enjoyment, there are some compelling reasons to add spring and summer flowering bulbs to your landscape. Doing so helps to bolster biodiversity, something we're increasingly losing thanks to competition from invasive plants such as kudzu and winter creeper. Land development has also taken a bite out of natural forage opportunities for insect pollinators. By incorporating early and late bloomers into your garden beds, or even throughout parts of your lawn, you can at the very least help to extend what's on the menu for area honeybees and other beneficial bugs. What's more, depending on the types of flowering bulbs you choose, you may be able to give them a much-needed nutritional boost during periods when nectar and pollen are harder to come by. Failing flowers. Since the mid-1990s, researchers from around the world have investigated the effects of warming temperatures on plants and flowers. Temperature changes have been shown to influence the amount of nectar individual flowers produce. Heat stress can negatively affect nectar quality, pollen performance, and more. Warming temperatures and changes in weather patterns have also contributed to the success of many invasive plant species. These invasive plants, in turn, are crowding out many of the native plants on which some beneficial insects have come to rely. With these extra challenges in mind, mixing in certain types of flowering bulbs, as well as flowers which grow from rhizomes, corms, and tubers, may become increasingly important for attracting and sustaining pollinators. Types to try. If you hope to provide real value to honeybees and native beneficial insects, keep in mind that not every flower bulb variety is created equal. As is the case with all kinds of flowers, when plant breeders focus their attention on selecting for bloom size, petal color, disease resistance, and so on, other traits, such as the amount and quality of nectar, for instance, can suffer. That's why some older and plainer varieties may be better choices than fancy new cultivars when you're specifically catering to pollinators. Hoping to determine which bulbs had the most staying power and the ability to attract area pollinators, University of Arkansas researchers grew 30 early spring flowering bulbs within a couple types of warm season turf grass. Over a three-year period, they investigated low-growing flower varieties such as Grecian windflower, winter aconite, and spring starflower, among others. As a group, the crocus and grape hyacinths were most successful at both persisting and providing a pollinator habitat, the researchers noted. Honeybees were particularly drawn to the crocus cultivars Golden Yellow, Blue Pearl, Cream Beauty, Spring Beauty, and Remembrance. As for grape hyacinths, good performers included Muscari armeniacum and Muscari neglecticum, as well as the specific cultivars Valerie Finis and Mount Hood. The study was published in the journal Hort Science in 2019. Notable natives. Although you may not necessarily find them at every big box store or even your favorite local nursery, native bulbs and corms are also worth seeking out. There is no need to dig up and store them over the winter, and they're also more likely to spread on their own. Another benefit is that they're great for supporting native bees, so depending on your local climate, you might consider adding some of the following natives, along with those crocuses and grape hyacinths. Psst, if you can't find any suppliers in your region, try one of the specialty native plant retailers online. Blue Flag Iris. Hardy in U.S. Zones 3 through 9, the Blue Flag Iris puts out its blue-violet blooms early, beginning in early to mid-spring. Blue Flag Irises don't mind wet feet, so plant it in moist, loamy soil. This native iris typically grows a little over 2 feet tall. Camas Lily, sometimes called the wild hyacinth, this late spring bloomer is hardy in zones 3 through 9, 3 through 8, and is suited to average to moist, loamy soil. Camas lilies put out spiky bluish-purple flowers and are just under 2 feet high at maturity. Louisiana Iris. Reaching about 3 feet tall, Louisiana irises are larger and showier than blue flag irises, and they perform best in average to moist, loamy soil. Blooms appear in early summer, with varying colors depending on the Louisiana iris variety you choose. Types such as Bold Pretender feature pretty pinkish-red petals and are hardy from zones 4 through 9. Blazing Star. Hardy in zones 3 through 9, Blazing Star can reach 2 to 4 feet and sets its spiky purple blooms in mid to late summer. Blazing Star thrives in slightly loamy, well-draining soil. Nodding Onion. Hardy in zones 3 through 8, nodding onions prefer average to dry loamy soil and full sun. Typically, they reach a little over a foot tall and will put out heads of tiny lavender flowers in midsummer. Michigan lily. This early to midsummer bloomer is hardy in zones 3 through 8 and prefers moist, loamy soil. Michigan lilies will grow up to 5 feet tall and put out orangey-red flowers with sharply curving petals. Wood lily. Also known as the prairie lily, wood lilies are hardy in zones 3 to 7 and look a lot like tiger lilies. However, wood lilies are just a foot tall at maturity. Watch for blooms in mid to late summer. The best start. Whether you're buying from a brick-and-mortar retailer or a specialty seller online, choose bulbs that have been nursery-propagated rather than sourced from the wild. This is especially important if you're purchasing some of the more difficult-to-find native bulbs and corms. And before you plant, examine each bulb for signs of damage from pests or disease. Ideally, bulbs should feel solid with no significant cuts or squishy spots. When planting crocuses, grape hyacinths, and other spring flowering bulbs, be sure to get them in the ground at least a few weeks before your average first frost. As for summer or fall blooming bulbs, most of these are planted during spring when the soil is easily worked and the danger of frost has passed. How to? Once it's planting time, use the following steps to ensure that your bulbs have optimal growing conditions and adequate rodent protection too. Step 1. Use a trowel or bulb planter to dig one hole per bulb or corm. Follow nursery package directions for planting depth. If directions aren't available, most bulbs should be seated in a hole that's at least twice as deep as the bulb is wide. Temporarily set aside the excavating soil. Step 2. Add aged compost to the bottom of the planting hole. Mix some extra compost in with the excavated soil you set aside in the previous step. You may be able to skip amending with compost if your planting bed is already nutrient-rich and well-draining. Step 3. Fashion a section of hardware cloth or chicken wire into a small cage. For hardware cloth, use heavy-duty tin snips. For lightweight chicken wire, a simple pair of wire-cutting pliers should do the trick. Place the bulb inside its protective cage and then carefully close the cage's top. When buried, the cage should keep chipmunks, mice, and other critters from damaging or devouring your bulb. Incidentally, once you notice plant leaves begin to show in the spring or later in the summer, you'll want to dig around until you've exposed the top of the bulb cage. With the cage bulb still firmly planted in the ground, gently make a few bends or cuts in the cage's top to make more room for the top of the growing plant. Then replace the soil around the newly freed plant top. Step 4. With the bulb tucked safely inside, bury the cage inside the hole. Remember, your bulb's planted depth should be at least twice as deep as the bulb is wide. The small corms of crocuses, for instance, are best planted at around 3 inches deep. Much larger bulbs, such as tulips, should be planted 5 or 6 inches deep. Step 5. Cover the caged bulb with your soil compost mixture. This will act as a slow-release fertilizer, delivering a supply of all natural nutrients and micronutrients for more robust roots, leaves, and ultimately flowers. Optional for added protection from digging critters, disguise any freshly disturbed areas with a couple of inches of dried leaves, pine needles, or wood chips. Step 6. If the soil is dry, go ahead and water in the bulb. Just take care to avoid waterlogged soil, as this can cause some newly planted bulbs to rot. Susan M. Brackney is a freelance writer and the author of Plan B, Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About the Hardest Working Creatures on the Planet. We're going to switch to Mother Earth News, February-March 2024. This article is called Machinery and Mud, Minimize Compaction to Support Healthy Soil on Your Farm. This is by Oscar H. Will III. Healthy soils are much more than dirt. In fact, some might argue they're some of the largest living organisms that serve to help make this planet habitable. The structural, chemical, and biological diversity in healthy soil is mind-blowing, in spite of the affronts we've thrown at soil over the years. Rather than thinking of soil as some inanimate growth medium, consider it a complex ecosystem instead. Not just dirt. Soil structure is key to maintaining its productivity, but also key to the ways water, gases, organic nutrients, and minerals move through the greater ecosystem of Earth. Essentially, soils consist of variously sized particles made with silt, sand, clay, and organic matter, bound together to form aggregates in a somewhat consistent way. The aggregates are stabilized by a glue of sorts that's created by the living organisms residing in that soil. The aggregates are porous and collectively form channels and pockets that allow fluids and gases, as well as invertebrates and microbes, to grow and move around. The spaces in the soil structure allow the soil to breathe, drink, and move nutrients around, and truly support terrestrial life in significant ways. In a soil with a healthy structure, rainwater is readily absorbed. The oxygen needs of the plants, microbes, and animals living in that soil can be met, and the carbon dioxide they produce can make it back into the atmosphere. Further, when a healthy soil is relatively dry, its structure is usually more stable and weight-bearing. When it's wet, it becomes more plastic. When plastic soil encounters mechanical force, it moves. If that mechanical force is on the surface, the soil can be squashed to the extent that the aggregate structure is more or less destroyed, in a process known as compaction. Compaction reduces the pore size, water holding capacity, gas movement, nutrient movement capacity, and it reduces the soil's ability to support life. Control compaction. Whether considering your crop ground, perennial pastures and meadows, or even woodlands, traversing land when wet can lead to significant degradation of the soil's physical structure. Structural degradation of the soil then leads to a cascade of negative effects, including loss of water-absorbing capacity, destruction of microbiota, lost gas exchange capacity, and in the case of perennial matrices, damage to the plant roots themselves. While walking that wet ground won't cause significant damage, driving any type of machinery on it will most definitely cause damage, some of it long-term. On the farm, ranch, or ranch, two of the most significant forms of compaction are from animals and machinery. If you pick up a handful of soil and create a ball with it and throw it, if that ball stays intact until it hits the ground, your soil is far too wet to drive on. If you can squeeze it and create a ribbon more than an inch long, it's too wet. If you absolutely must traverse that land, plan ahead and build a road or create a grassy strip with a sod forming and forgiving grass species, such as tall fescue. But even then, your best bet will be to wait for the field to dry. In your perennial pastures and hay meadows, you might identify routes to get from one place to another and accept that you'll damage the matrix beneath the tire tracks. Ideally, plan these paths away from low, damp areas or other fragile areas, such as thinly vegetated sandy hill prone to erosion. If you were to take a different route through these areas every time, you'd do more damage over a wider area, even if you avoid creating muddy ruts on a more well-used pathway. It's much easier to maintain ruts than to mitigate widespread moderate compaction on pastures and hay meadows. If you drive on perennial matrices and leave any indentation or raise muddy water, it's too wet to be out there unless absolutely necessary. When running livestock on pastures, it's not always possible to avoid compaction, but there are some things you can do to minimize the damage from hooves. Reduce your stocking rate by giving the animals more space, or move the herds to more stable, higher, drier ground if a significant rain event is in the forecast. Many folks have designated sacrifice paddocks, where they bring animals when soil conditions are too wet. You'll damage the matrix in those areas, but if you feed hay in them and move the feeder around, you can later plant some compaction-fighting cover crops and work toward partial restoration of that damaged soil. Repair and restoration. Entire books have been written on how to mitigate and restore compaction-damaged soils. You can use your tractor and blade to smooth out ruts formed in your permanent two-track lanes so they'll continue to be usable, and so you'll avoid the temptation to make new lanes adjacent to the old ones. You can also rip-till for short-term relief, but in the end, a more complex and integrated approach is needed. It'll take years to reduce compaction to pre-human levels, but in relatively short order, you can repair that sacrifice paddock or that low area where the tractor and combine get stuck. In time, those damaged soils will heal sufficiently to become truly productive again. That's all the time we have. You've been listening to Natural Life. I'm Kim McCurdy. As always, thanks for listening.